Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Summer is right around the corner, and with it, summer travel. As if on cue, in the face of spiking fuel prices, airlines are announcing huge losses and staff cutbacks. Ticket prices are soaring. Big carriers are trimming their schedules. That means crowded planes, delays, and cancellations. This hour on Point, we're taking a close look at the airline industry, the future of flying, and what that means for you. Joining me now from Washington is Lisa Stark, correspondent for ABC News. She covers aviation. Hi, Lisa. Great to have you with us.
Thank you, Jane. Nice to be here.
Also from Washington is David Field, America's editor for Airline Business Magazine. David, thank you for joining us.
It's my pleasure.
Lisa, let me start with you. The news has not been good for the airlines this week. United reporting first quarter losses of $537 million. Delta first quarter losses of more than $6 billion. What does all this tell us about the state of the airline industry?
The airline industry is drowning, if you will. The high cost of jet fuel is taking an enormous toll on the industry. They had started to recover finally from 9/11. They were making money. This has sent them, if you will, into a tailspin. These prices are just going up and up. Jet fuel has gone up 60% since a year ago at this time, and they are just struggling under the cost.
And these costs being passed on to the consumers, if you will, in terms of ticket prices?
They're trying to. I mean, the airlines will argue they don't have what they call a lot of pricing power, but they have managed to push through 8 price hikes since January. 4 of those are fuel surcharges, and 4 of them are actually price hikes, but the airlines will say it's not anywhere nearly enough. In fact, the CEO of Delta this week indicated that prices would really have to come up another 20% or so for them to recoup the cost of jet fuel.
Right. And so, David, can the airlines get away with that? Will competitors join in? You know, will higher fares lower the demand for travel and, you know, maybe prompt carriers to cut their schedules even more?
Higher fares will prompt a competitor, and you don't even need higher fares to prompt a competitor to undercut you in the airline business. You know, the airline business is unique in that your pricing is determined not by you, but by your lowest cost competitor or, in many cases, your dumbest competitor. So if there's a guy out there like Skybus, which went out of business a couple weeks ago, if there's someone out there like Skybus selling seats at $10 a pop, and they think they can get away with it, you're forced into $10 a seat sales also, which means you don't really have the kind of pricing power you should be able to have.
Lisa, you mentioned fuel prices, and with crude oil now pushing $120 a barrel, can the industry survive in its current form if fuel continues to go up?
And we should mention that jet fuel is even more expensive. It's $138 to $148 a barrel. So they pay a premium on top of that. It's a good question. Many in the industry feel there has to be a major restructuring. That's why we see Delta and Northwest arguing that they need to merge. Other people feel that some carriers may end up going out of business. And the problem is they don't know where this is going. Is jet fuel going to stop at this level? Is it going to keep going up? There's a lot of uncertainty. These prices are very, very difficult for the industry. And I think, and David would, I think, agree with me that it could lead to some wholesale changes in what the industry looks like.
What would those be, David, those wholesale changes?
Fewer airlines is the biggest change. We're certainly going to see this summer fewer flights. We're going to see more crowded flights. We're going to see smaller planes wherever the carriers can get away with putting smaller planes on the route. But I think we will see fewer airlines. The airlines that have gone out of business so far have been on the fringes. They've been relatively small carriers. The largest of them was Aloha out in Hawaii. Mm-hmm. And they were 27, 28 airplanes. They were the second carrier in a rather small market. But I think you will see, if this keeps up, you will see by this winter someone considerably larger either going out of business or simply parking a lot of airplanes.
Talk about Aloha Airlines and some of the others, ATA, Skybus. But, you know, we're not just talking about problems with Delta and Northwest. It's JetBlue and AirTran, two formerly fast-growing discount carriers, Lisa, that also posted first-quarter losses, didn't they?
Absolutely. You know, in the past, the discount carriers might be growing 10, 20% a year. Well, that has ended at this point. Their flat growth or minimal growth. They are also looking at whether they need to park some planes. It's just a very tough time. As one analyst told me, the airlines are looking at every plane and every city they serve to try to figure out if there are any routes that they can make profitable and what routes are so bad for them that they need to actually stop flying those runs. So they are having to look at everything they do in the face of these fuel costs.
And what about these additional charges, these fees that five of the six major carriers just announced that they'll charge up to $25 to check a second piece of luggage? Then there are the charges to reserve seats in advance, charges for extra leg room, for the headsets, for the food. I mean, are these some of the changes that are here to stay, Lisa?
Well, luckily so far we don't have to pay for the bathroom, and hopefully that will stay. I think the airlines feel they really don't have any choice at this point because, as David mentioned, they can't raise fares as much as they'd like because they are perhaps faced with competitors who will undercut them, and it is a very competitive business. They're looking for other ways, sort of a la carte pricing, if you will, to get money. And their feeling is that, look, if you don't want to pay the $25, pack more lightly. They're giving you a choice. If you don't want to watch the movie, you don't have to pay for the headset. So they're giving consumers choice. And as you know, many of these airlines are exempting their frequent flyers, their best customers from these. So they're not alienating their best customers, and the others who fly maybe once or twice a year, well, they don't mind zinging them with an extra fee.
What do you make, David, of this a la carte pricing, as Lisa mentioned?
Oh, I think this a la carte pricing or unbundling is certainly here to stay. When it started, the airlines were able to tout it as a way of giving you a choice. They've become a lot more honest in the last few weeks. United, when they came out with their huge loss on Monday or Tuesday, was very blunt about it. No, we're just doing it to raise revenue. There is no correlation between the $25 for the second bag and what it actually costs us. We need the money, and we will look anywhere and everywhere we can to zing you with a couple of bucks here and a couple of bucks there.
What about travelers in all this? You know, you hear the same stories, jammed planes, delayed flights, you know, on top of the higher fares. You know, are Americans just going to have to put up with this, Lisa?
Well, they've put up with it for a while, and I think it's going to continue. This summer especially will likely be bad. I think the only thing that could make it easier if fares actually get high enough that people stop flying, or if the economy worsens even further and people just say, you know what, I'm not going to take that trip. That may lessen the load, if you will, a little bit. But the planes are packed, and they're packed for a reason, because the airlines are cutting flights. They're trying to run fewer flights, and they're trying to pack people in planes to make money. And so you're going to have very full planes, which means, of course, if you miss your flight, you're going to have trouble getting on another one, as we saw last summer. Whenever there's bad weather, we see that happens. And that's just going to be the reality for travelers in the future.
David, Lisa reminded us of last summer, those record delays and cancellations. Are we in for more of that, more of the same upcoming?
Oh, I think we are. You know, Lisa mentioned people not traveling. And everyone is afraid of people not traveling, but it hasn't happened yet. We keep on saying, well, if fares go up this much, will they stop traveling? No. If we cut this many flights, will they stop traveling? No. People keep lining up with cash money to get on the airplane. Mm-hmm. And I don't know when the demand curve is going to be stifled. My gut is that we will have to be in a pretty deep recession before people stop traveling.
We heard for a while about a so-called passenger bill of rights, Lisa. Does that exist? Did it ever go anywhere? Should it exist?
Oh, it exists somewhere in the halls of Congress. No,
right.
I believe it did pass the House, but it has stalled in the Senate. It hasn't gone anywhere in the Senate. And there was a lot of push for it this year after the incident with JetBlue last year, I should say, with the incident over Valentine's Day where they stranded folks on the tarmac for many, many, many hours. And there was an incident with American Airlines where folks were stranded as well. There was a huge uproar. Congress got involved. But as these things often happen, it hasn't really gone anywhere. And I don't think at this point, I would be very surprised to see it pass at this point, but anything could happen.
Before we go to... No, David, go ahead.
Sorry.
No, please.
I don't think it will pass. It was going to come up this week in the Senate, but hasn't so far. One of the interesting factors is a number of states were looking at state laws to govern the airline service within their states. New York State had an airline passenger bill of rights. It was struck down by a federal court, which claimed that states had no right to federal preemption, so-called, kept the states out of this federal business. And that, I would have thought, would have given the Bill of Rights a push, but it has not succeeded yet.
Go ahead.
No, please.
I was just going to add one thing. The Inspector General at the Department of Transportation has testified recently about how airlines are doing voluntarily on this issue, because the airlines always say, well, we'll enact our own Bill of Rights and we're going to protect our passengers. And he says there's still a lot of holes in that. So if it is a bad summer, airline passengers may face some of the things they faced before, which is long waits on planes without adequate food, without clean bathrooms, without enough water.
And fresh air, not to mention.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about airline industry woes, the high fuel prices and the rising cost of travel. How much are you willing to pay for a plane ticket? Do you go for the best deal, or are you loyal to certain carriers to earn those precious frequent flyer miles? My guests today are Lisa Stark, correspondent for ABC News, and David Field, America's editor for Airline Business Magazine. I'd like to ask you first both about the mergers. We touched on it a little bit in the first segment, but tell us more about it. Delta, Northwest, anything on tap for United and American? Where does that stand, Lisa?
Well, Delta and Northwest CEOs are on Capitol Hill today, and they are making their case that this would be great for the country, it would be great for passengers, it would be great for the world.
Would it?
It's a hard case. It's a hard case. Well, the problem is that they're promising the moon because they know politicians are worried. They know politicians are thinking about, are they going to pull out of my city? Are they going to close my hub? Are they going to fire our employees who live in my area? So they announced this merger and then proceeded to insist that nothing would get cut, which doesn't ring very true in these days of high oil prices. So I think they're facing a very skeptical audience on Capitol Hill, although, of course, they don't have a vote. The congressmen don't. It's up to the Department of Justice and the shareholders on whether to approve the merger. But I think most of those on Capitol Hill firmly believe that if the merger goes through, that we will see cuts, simply because of the realities of the business today.
David Field, what do you think?
Yeah, but we'd see cuts anyway. I certainly think that Delta and Northwest have overpromised in this case. It's a weird merger in that most mergers come out with promises based on cutting capacity, getting rid of a number of flights, and both Delta and Northwest have sworn up and down they won't get rid of anything. And they made a very strange argument, a sort of a cow's ear argument. You know, they don't have any airplanes in common except for one type. Northwest has an older fleet. Northwest has an Airbus fleet. Delta has an all Boeing fleet. And what they said was, oh, no, it doesn't matter that our fleets have nothing in common. It doesn't matter that we won't be able to save money on synergies, so-called, of maintenance and so on, because we'll have the right size airplane for every market that we have, which I can't really accept. And I suspect Congress is going to be quite skeptical about this morning.
I mentioned United and American. Anything on tap for those two also very large carriers, Lisa?
Not with each other, I hope.
Yeah. No?
What, do you have miles on both, David?
Lisa, I think you've probably heard the same rumors that I have, that United and Continental are talking. We also heard earlier this week that United and U.S. Airways have resumed their talks. You know that the last really big merger in this country was in the fall of 1985 when U.S. Airways and America West, the fall of 2005, that dates me, when America West and U.S. Air got together and formed U.S. Airways. There has not been a merger since then. Back in 1999, 2000, U.S. Airways and United did talk about merging. But it was blocked. It was blocked by Congress and by the administration.
I think most people believe, and I'm not a, I'm not on Wall Street, I'm not an analyst, but most people do believe that we will see other mergers, or at least merger deals announced. Whether they'll go through is another issue. But I think the carriers feel strength in numbers. Bigger is better, and that's what they're all looking toward right now.
Sort of a necessity, sort of a sign of the times, Lisa?
That's how they see it. They think, especially with the Delta Northwest merger, they've made the point that there's very little route overlap. I think they said in their 1,000 domestic routes, they have 12 in common, and they have very different international routes. So their point is that they can create a world airline. They can compete on the world stage. They can get a traveler anywhere, and that's why it makes economic sense.
What about the economic impact? Lisa, you touched on it, on some of these cities where some of these troubled airlines have hubs. How does it impact, these various points around the country?
Well, as David mentioned, there will be cuts, whether there are mergers or not. I think air service is essential these days. And I think the fact that we haven't seen folks dialing back on their travel shows that it's become the way people get places. And it's the lifeblood of cities. So cities are very concerned if they lose air service. It affects them economically. It affects jobs. It affects the ability of business to come into that city. And there are cities that will be very, very concerned as airlines start cutting back. Now, what airlines will often tell you is that they're not going to pull out entirely. They're just going to cut frequency. So maybe they have four flights out of Duluth, they'll have three. And some of that is true. But I think this is unfolding, and I think some cities may end up finding that they have much, much less air service than they want and that they have now.
And part of that, Jane, if I can cut in, is the economics of the small airplane, the 50-seat regional jet. When they came in 10 years ago, travelers hailed them. They didn't have propellers, therefore they were safe and wonderful. They happen to be extremely expensive to operate, and the cuts that have been announced so far by Delta and by Northwest, by others as well, have been cuts of 50-seat routes, which means you're going to see cities like Cincinnati, cities like Memphis, losing spokes out of their hubs, and the spokes go to places like Duluth, Clinton, Tennessee, places like that. And you will see small towns like Meridian, Mississippi, down to one flight a day.
So, in fact, one analyst told me that out of the 1,600 or so 50-seat jets that are out there now, he expects at least half of them will be parked within the next 5 years. They just can't make it economical to run them right now.
Lisa Stark, David Field, hold on just a moment. I'd like to bring another voice into this conversation. Joining me from Sacramento is Joe Dion. He's a pilot with a major commercial airline, and he's the host of the podcast Fly With Me. Joe, great to have you with us.
Hi, Jane. How you doing?
So you've been flying commercially for about 20 years now. What are you hearing from passengers in this new age of air travel?
Well, typically my conversation with a passenger goes something like this. I say bye-bye, and they say thank you. And that's the content of most of our conversations. But sometimes sitting in the terminal, I'll get talking to somebody, and they want to know what's coming down the pike for them. They'll ask me, are you guys going to merge, or are you guys going to raise prices and things like that? But honestly, they're asking the wrong person. I'm not an analyst. I'm kind of in it with the rest of the employees, just kind of riding it out.
Well, give us your sense of how things have changed since you started working as an airline pilot and sort of how things are today.
Well, I got to tell you, the industry's really never been healthy since I was first hired. When I was hired, in my original training class, a group of 19 pilots, and they're all bright-eyed and bushy-tailed in the mornings, and they were telling us the airline industry is going to go like gangbusters. You guys are all going to be captains in a couple of years, and we're going to make money like, by the bushel. But it never turned out like they said. Mm. It's been kind of one obstacle and one problem after another for the airlines. So the news, although, it's very depressing, the news we've seen lately about high fuel costs and so on, it's not exactly shocking to us. It's not a big surprise to us. We've been hearing a lot of bad news for a long time.
We've also been hearing recently about the FAA inspections of aircraft within the industry. Have passengers been more concerned, to your mind, about safety?
Yeah.
What do they ask you?
Actually, I've had a couple people mention things like that to me. They ask me, is it safe? Basically, just like that. And I got to tell you, safety is a very hard thing to measure. I know that I do everything that I can in the cockpit to make sure that I fly a safe airplane. And all the pilots that I fly with do the same thing. As far as that goes, I wouldn't fly if it wasn't safe. After all, you know, I'm in that seat too.
What about your financial status, Joe? Pilots have been facing, you know, pay cuts in recent years. What do you hear your compadres saying, given all the bad news of high fuel prices and the reduced schedules and such?
Yeah, that's been a big topic of discussion. As far as that's concerned, you know, I fly the same way that I did when I was making a lot more than I am now. That's not going to change how I fly the airplane. But some of us are concerned that lower wages for pilots will translate into a smaller pool of well-qualified people applying for the jobs in the future. So we're concerned that that's going to impact safety down the road, and there's a possibility that carriers, when they're struggling, are going to cut corners in maintenance. And so it's a concern when the crunch is on for cost cutting, you know.
Do you think the airlines, Joe, can pull out of this latest trouble?
I don't have a crystal ball. I've seen the news look a lot like this before in the past, after 9/11, and I think that some people were making very dire predictions that didn't come true. I see it happening again. I'm just going to remain hopeful. After all, from my position, this is what I'm trained to do. This is what I know how to do. It would take a lot for me to, you know, retrain into a different career field. I'm pretty much wedded to this profession. So I'm hopeful that I'll still have a job until I retire.
Well, good luck to you. Joe Dion is a pilot and host of the podcast Fly With Me. Appreciate your time, Joe. Take care.
Thank you, Jane.
Let's go to the phones and welcome some listeners to our conversation now. Ned is in Afton, Virginia. Ned, welcome to On Point.
Hello. Thank you so much.
Yes, welcome.
My background is that over the 1978 to 1980 time period, I wrote the environmental impact statement for the deregulation of the airlines. And at that time, there were a number of economists that said that deregulation would be a catastrophe. And without going into the details, I do understand what the naysayers were saying, and it appears to me that they were actually dead on. That this thing back then that they were calling consumer surplus, which would accrue to the traveling public because of savings, would actually just eat away at the system until there were no profits or the system was operating negatively so long that eventually that the losses of the airlines would pretty much be equal to this this benefit to the public in dollar terms. And here we are. So I'm calling specifically to suggest that deregulation has failed and that it's time to reconsider some entity like the Civil Aeronautics Board and going back to regulating.
To re-regulation. Ned, I appreciate your time and your call. Thanks. Let's ask our guests. Lisa Stark, David Field. Re-regulation.
I'm going to let David start with that
okay.
one. What do you think, David?
listen, there have been a fair number of calls for re-regulation. There have been calls for re-regulation since I started in this business back in the 1980s. Which means it's nothing new. What's new is that you're getting some smart people and some sane people calling for re-regulation. Now, the only problem is you can't do it. The system has evolved in such a manner that it simply could not be regulated again the way it was back up until 1978. Airlines had to go to the CAB, the Civil Aeronautics Board, known in Washington as the Civil Aerobatics Board, for every time they wanted to raise or lower a fare, every time they wanted to change a schedule, that sort of thing. And you simply could not create that kind of bureaucracy again. And even if you could, I really think it would backfire.
And I think some people would argue it's created a much less stable industry in some ways. Others will argue that it has led to a lot of lower fares than you might think, believe it or not, even in these days when they're going up, and also a lot of cities that have air service that might not otherwise.
Oh, it really has led to lower fares, which is the stated goal of the legislation, that more people would fly. Whether or not that's been good for the airlines is very much an open question.
More calls now. George is in Charleston, South Carolina. George, welcome to the program.
Hello, Jane.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
Certainly.
And if I may say, your program On Point is probably my favorite program. It's a great program overall.
Good.
The one question I had was, how are the European airlines surviving? They've had gas costs that we have now, $4 or $5 a gallon. I'm not quite sure how that relates to fuel, airline fuel, but how do they manage to survive and continue? How is their situation? Second, I've been hearing a number of programs saying that the airlines have been losing vast sums of money for years now. That, but my other question in regard to that is that how are they still flying? Flying, I should say. How is it possible to keep going if so many comments said the airlines are losing billions? I mean, basically, that's those are my comments.
All right, George, thanks so much for your call. Appreciate it. First, the situation in Europe. How is air travel different there? David?
European airlines face the same pressures we do. They're different in that they started with a higher cost base. They paid more for fuel to begin with. They also have very distinctive patterns. The low-fare carriers in Europe have far more airports to land at to deal with than we do. And the big carriers in Europe have come off of being owned by nations, being flag carriers. Lufthansa, British Airways, Air France, KLM were all, within very recent memory, in the last 7, 8, 9 years, were owned by governments and came off of that. So they're still in their early years of operating as a private business. And that certainly puts them into a much stronger position.
I've been reading, Lisa, that in Europe, passengers are, you know, reimbursed for lost time due to canceled flights and such. I mean, it's a very different system.
They do have some protections or some things like that that you don't have here in the United States. And there had been attempts to get some of that into legislation here, but it was a non-starter. And I also think, and David, you can correct me if I'm wrong about this, the price of oil is pegged to the dollar. And in Europe, they're paying in euros, which, as we know,
That's
is a
right.
lot stronger than the dollar right now. So even though fuel costs have gone up substantially, it hasn't been as big a burden on those carriers that are paying in euros versus American carriers who are paying in American dollars.
And that has another effect. Most U.S. airlines lose money domestically and make money on their international routes. Mm. That's starting to change because the international routes are paid for in euros or in other stronger currencies, and that puts them at a disadvantage when they're getting paid in euros but paying out in dollars.
And the other thing international carriers have done just quickly is they've created large – they've merged KLM and Air France, for example, which is another reason why U.S. carriers are arguing that they need to do the same.
Tracy is on the line now from Boston. Welcome, Tracy, to the program.
Hi. Lovely to have you take my call.
Thanks
I'm a
for
Delta
calling.
Flight attendant.
And you're a Delta flight attendant. Okay.
I am. And I'm also one of the steering committee for AFA to get us organized. And what we've been met with is complete interference. We've had 17 senators write a letter to our executives at Northwest and Delta asking them to not interfere. But the main concern that we have as Delta flight attendants is that 2 years ago, Richard Anderson, who is our CEO now, tried to outsource 75% of the international flying to foreign nationals at a lower rate of pay and less compensation. So we feel that a contract is very valuable to us just in order to keep our jobs. But unfortunately, we're being met with a lot of misrepresentations as to how, you know, a union would affect us in a negative way. And unfortunately, it's almost like battered wife syndrome. A lot of the employees are believing it. Mm.
Tracy, thanks so much for your call. There you hear it from Tracy. Outsourcing the jobs. There's a lot of people affected by this. Let's talk more about it after the break. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. Much more to come and more of your calls. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the future of the airline industry and how it looks in the wake of high fuel prices and rising ticket prices. My guests today are Lisa Stark, correspondent for ABC News, and David Field, America's editor for Airline Business Magazine. I'm curious, in this age of jammed planes and delayed flights, why do airlines still overbook? Why do they still overbook flights, Lisa?
Because not everyone shows up. The only carrier that I'm aware of that truly has a no overbooking policy is JetBlue, and they bump almost no one off their flights. But airlines have to fill those seats, and they're worried if you don't show up, you cancel at the last minute. They want that seat filled, and I'm sure they have computer programs that tell them exactly how much they can overbook, and it's usually fine, and sometimes it's not. The good news, if there is any for travelers, is that the Department of Transportation has just raised the compensation you'll get if you get bumped off a flight. Hmm. So if you do get bumped off a flight now, airlines may have to pay you as much as $800, depending on the circumstances. So at least there's some compensation there.
You might want to get bumped at this point, sounds like.
Maybe,
actually,
yeah.
You know, Jane,
yeah.
There are a lot of people who want to get bumped, and that's one of the reasons why airlines overbook. There's a whole subculture of bumpies, guys who go to the airport hoping to get bumped because they really want that free flight to Hawaii and so on.
Interesting. Glad I asked. Rick is on the phone now from Canton, New York. Rick, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane. Thanks a lot.
Yeah.
The question I have is what actually happens? What's the decision-making process when you have a JetBlue-type situation, 3 hours on a plane and the toilets are overflowing and there's no food going to the passengers? From my standpoint, uninformed potential victim in that, I'm thinking, why can't we bring a bus out, unload everybody, put them in a secure area if that's a problem, and feed them?
Good question.
It doesn't make sense to me.
Rick, thanks so much for the call. Lisa, do you have an answer?
Well, airlines, in fact, and airports are starting to try to work out plans like that. Whether they'll work in practice is another question. With the JetBlue incident, for example, that was a huge ice storm. Planes were stranded. I don't know if there were even gates open. It was a logistical nightmare that day, and it definitely got away from the airline and from the airport. But airports have started to work up contingency plans. They're identifying buses for just this reason. If you have to get the passengers off, they're trying to figure out how they would stock up on extra food supplies, even diapers. So there are plans being made, but again, whether they will be put into practice and whether they will go smoothly, I think that's a big question.
Did JetBlue make changes after that incident on the tarmac?
Oh yeah, they fired the CEO. the founder of JetBlue, David Neeleman, stepped down, became chairman. Now he's stepping down from that, and it was pretty much a direct result of the Valentine's Day 2007 massacre, as people call it. But
Go
ahead. I'm sorry.
Nope, I was just saying they instituted their own sort of passenger bill of rights, if you will.
Right.
Did they not?
They did indeed. Whether or not it will work at a place like JFK is very much an open question. Bear in mind that JetBlue is operating not just from a terminal there, but from a hangar. Mm-hmm. There's literally a hangar that they have that they're using while they build their new terminal. And that creates all sorts of ground side constraints. And it really would be very difficult to get the airplane back to the gate because there's almost always another airplane at the gate. Physically, you know, airports are very constrained. Kennedy is a very constrained airport. It's surrounded by water and railroads and development, and there's simply no way to grow it. And that's the case at many of our big city airports.
Tom is on the line now from Norwich, Vermont. Tom, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Yep.
I wonder if we can minimize moving forward here or maybe even get rid of this whole hub system. I think the real problem with the hub system is that it doubles your chances of having some kind of big weather problem. I'm lucky enough to live near a Southwest airport, and because virtually all of their flights are direct, I always feel much more confident that I'm actually going to get to my destination on the day I'm supposed to get there. Mm.
Good question, Tom. Thanks. What about eliminating the hub system, Lisa?
But if you live in a small city, then you can forget your air service, because the way the hub system works is that it allows airlines to take, you know, smaller groups of people and move them to a bigger area and then fly them out. And I think that system has allowed a number of small cities to have air service that might not otherwise have it, simply because the demand isn't there and they wouldn't see the kind of air service that they get. Now, these low-cost carriers such as Southwest, JetBlue, for example, who fly more point-to-point, I think that's one of the reasons they are so popular, because people like to do that. But not everyone lives near a Southwest airport or a JetBlue or an AirTran airport, and they are forced to work with this hub system.
What do you think, David? Eliminating the hub system?
I wish you could do it, but you can't. It's like re-regulation. You can't put the toothpaste back in the tube. And, you know, the real problem with hubs is, why do you insist on having cities where the thunderstorms go? I mean, look at where the cities are. Memphis, Chicago, Cincinnati. There are so many cities are right in the path of the boomers.
Yeah,
and
how dare
there's
they?
Just nothing we can do about that.
Wendy on the line now from Hartford, Vermont. Welcome to the program, Wendy.
Yeah, hi. I my comment is, I guess, similar to the question, the comment Tom just had. But back in the 60s, when I used to fly with my parents, my father retired, moved to California from Philadelphia, and of course, that's a major city. But it would take us 4 to 5 hours, depending on the winds, either way. Now, I just flew in from California on Sunday, 13 hours door to door.
Whoa.
You know, in the 60s, I used to think, oh, my gosh, I wonder what it's going to be like, you know, 30, 40 years from now. We'll be able to go across the country in a couple hours. Mm. And when I think of my complete loss of an entire day to fly what used to be 4 or 5 hours, it's pretty amazing. Mm. And also, I'm not a real tall person or weigh a lot, and I took an overnight flight, and I could barely move in my seat. And all I could think about is, what about these people who are 6 feet tall, can't go business class, and, you know, weigh an average weight of a male? It's ridiculous. I could not move in my seat.
You know, it leads us to a good question, Lisa. Thank you for your call, Wendy. Have these seats been scrunched together? Have they been moved tighter to fit more in?
Have you ever been on an airplane where you get into your row and all of a sudden you realize there's no window in that row? Well, why is that? The plane wasn't designed that way. It's because they've put an extra row or two of seats in and they've scrunched them all up. Right. I mean, airlines have definitely packed in the seats to get more people on these planes. And a number of them, as you mentioned earlier in the broadcast, are charging you extra if you want the seat with the little extra leg room or that aisle seat. And that's just the reality of flying today.
You know, Wendy's call reminds me, our producer for this hour, Tanya Raleigh, she was telling us about how her parents, who worked for Pan Am in the 70s, you know, the perception of air travel has changed so much. You know, her mom was a flight attendant, these beautiful, you know, outfits and sort of this was a glamorous sort of job. Her father was director of food and wine for Pan Am. He flew around the world gathering the best wine for the travelers, and the stories that she tells of the globetrotting, the glamour, you know. It's so much have changed, including the perception of how we do this now, David.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, Pan Am is just the greatest example of what airlines used to be.
Right.
Pan Am was an airline where if a flight attendant got a letter of complaint about her, and it was all women, she was fired. But if a flight attendant got too many letters of praise, she was also fired or disciplined because the airline felt that extraordinary service was what was ordinarily required. It was simply a unique institution. But look at the difference. Pan Am back in the 1960s was for the truly wealthy, the truly elite, the rara avis, the rare bird who was able to live in the international culture. Yeah, it was different. People got on the airplane in coats and ties and so on. And now people get on in floppies and shorts. And even though I don't like the cultural change, I think you have to admit somewhere that the more people who fly, the more people who benefit from flying, the better it is.
Mark is on the line now from Niagara, New York. Mark, welcome to the program.
Thank you. I was just wondering, when you fly, you're paying a premium for speed, but people aren't willing to pay an unlimited premium for speed, as evident in the failure of the SST. And I was just wondering if there's any chance that turboprops could come back. You could, okay, it's not as fast as a jet, but it's much faster than a bus or an ocean liner or a train. Hmm. And I would seriously consider that if it was affordable. And
they are coming back.
Are they, David?
Oh, yeah. Fuel has made them very attractive. You know, before Lisa and I were talking about the 50-seat regional jet, that's being replaced in many places by a turboprop. There's a particular model called the Q400. It's made up in Canada by Bombardier. It has 70 seats. It goes nearly as quickly as a jet does. On a trip, an average trip length, say, Seattle to Portland, the difference is 12 or 15 minutes. Because you're not using turboprops on very long flights. Fortunately or unfortunately, I should say, the turboprop replacement has been limited to these regional routes, and you're not going to see any big new four-engine propeller planes coming along.
Ray now on the line from Des Moines, Iowa. Ray, welcome to the program. Hi.
Yeah, thanks, Jay. In 1947, or 77, it cost $247 round trip from Des Moines to Fairbanks. Huh. And I had to make three trips to get a job up there during the pipeline.
Mm-hmm.
And now I think the cost of that trip is $847.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
And...
Well, thanks for that. I know it's just going through the roof, Lisa. I mean, where does this stop? Where does this end, the increased airfares? And, you know, at some point, you just can't keep going.
Well, the airlines will argue that adjusted for inflation, airfares are actually lower than they were in about the year 2000. Hmm. So they will argue that the traveling public is still getting quite a bargain, even though it is very expensive on some routes.
Hmm. Here's another question from a caller in Buffalo, New York. Kitty, you're on the line. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Yes.
I have a question about baggage.
Okay.
My family and I flew to a wedding in Lafayette, Louisiana, and not one of our bags arrived until it was time to go home.
Oh, goodness.
The young woman in the hotel said, oh, they do that all the time. They dump baggage because there's a weight restriction, and they'd rather have the people on and the heck with the suitcases.
Oh, my goodness. Could that be, Lisa, dumping bags for weight restrictions?
David may know better than me, but certainly there are weight restrictions on planes, and the smaller the jet, the smaller the plane, obviously, the less weight you can carry. And I'm sure in some cases bags are left behind. David?
Oh yeah, and Lafayette happens to be a relatively small airport. All of the service in and out of Lafayette is on regional jets, where you do have real weight restrictions. So it may well be the case.
Hmm. Another couple of calls before we wrap up this hour. Linda is on the line now from Newbury, Vermont. Linda, welcome.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Yes.
You know, the thing that occurs to me as I listen to all this is I'm actually astonished that nobody is talking about the effect that airplane traffic has on global climate change and the fact that we're beginning to experience the effects of oil depletion and rising fuel costs that are probably going to bring the airlines down in the next few years anyway. I mean, why are we talking about propping up this industry when we should be looking at other ways to spend our money? And it seems like a terrible disconnect. Nobody's talking about the effects that airline traffic actually has on the planet.
It's an interesting perspective, and I appreciate you calling with it, Linda. Thanks. David Field, do you want to respond to that?
I can't really speak to the oil depletion syndrome. I know a lot of people talk about it. As for the environment, the airlines will defend themselves by saying that they produce a very small percentage of overall pollution, and even though the major causes of pollution are indeed mobile, they tend to be cars rather than airplanes. That's perfectly true. On the other hand, the airlines are finally getting around to doing some things about pollution, one of which is newer engine technologies, which is all very far in the future. They're also talking about biofuels. I'd argue there are a few things you can do in the short term, particularly in terms of air traffic control routings and more direct routings. Mm. Less congestion in the sky allows airplanes to fly directly to the airport and not have to be in holding patterns and so on. But, yeah, it's very much an issue. And with airlines losing money the way they are, you're going to see older airplanes with less efficient engines in service for some time yet.
Mm. David, you touched on this briefly a couple of minutes ago, but I wonder about the cultural effect of increased airfares and a changing airline industry. In some form, does it divide people? You know, if you can't afford to get on an airplane, divide people by socioeconomic class. Some can afford to fly, some can't. And then if you can't, on some level, does that become, you know, make us a little more insular as a society on some level, Lisa?
Well, I think, I mean, as David said, right now we haven't seen a lot of people decide not to go to the airport. Planes are still very full. People are buying tickets. But certainly if prices continue to go up, it does create a division. There are the people who will be able to get there by plane and those who will have to pack into their cars or not take the trip. And one of the things about deregulation is it has sort of democratized, if you will, air travel. And we could see a diminution of that, I suppose, if prices go really high and if the economy truly tanks.
David Field, I'll give you the last word.
We certainly could see a re-elitism of airlines. I think it's a long way off. I think that people are so used to having air travel and affordable air travel in this country that it's a permanent part of the culture as well as of the infrastructure.
What an interesting and lively conversation. I appreciate my guest today. Lisa Stark covers aviation for ABC News. Lisa, thanks so much for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
And David Field is the America's editor for Airline Business Magazine. David, great to talk to you. Thanks.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation and download the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.